But he wasn't going home now. He wasn't going to stay. There was something drawing him, tugging at him to be recalled. Greensboro, Montgomery, Port Gibson, Little Rock, Hattiesburg, Lowndes County, Cairo, Illinois, Claiborne. He'd sent a check. He knew that much. He could recall the check, the broad strokes he'd made with a flat point pen, the yellow check with his old phone number on it, but the rest of it would not come clear. Happy Mardi Gras! Like a shot ringing out, the quiet of the woods disturbed, an explosion by his ear and birds breaking from cover. Dressed in women's evening wear, the exaggerated shoulders and opulent chin from Hollywood's white telephone period, three young black men came prancing toward him, streamers curling down, floppy from their wigs, balloons bulging through the clothes. One held a toy trumpet to his lips and puffed and blew, though the mouthpiece never came in contact with the sloppily applied lipstick. His decolletage was bumpily hairy.
"We're starting in early," the blonde wig said. "Come join us."
Meadows stood frozen on the spot.
"Wait a minute. Can't go anywhere looking like that."
The third one with green balloon bosom and a pillow for buttocks had plopped his tote bag down on Meadows' toes and was fussily pulling out a pink satin gown, yards and yards of it like a magician's length of scarves.
"Don't worry."
He did not alter his voice as the others did, nor was he wearing heels. Just the wig, his own mustache, a striped taffeta jacket pulled in at the waist over Jean Harlow lounging pajamas, mix-match socks, and tennis shoes.
"Just put it on, and the role will play itself."
He stared at the gown. Were they serious? They didn't seem like queers for all their carrying on. He looked them over thoroughly since they made it clear it was expected of him. They were more his age than not. Maybe post office clerks or bus drivers? The man at his feet wore a wedding band and what looked like a marine ring. Blondie had a gash across his left brow, the bunched-up scar tissue giving him a querulous look. The bloodshot eyes said alcoholic, though he didn't seem to be tipsy, just confusing for Meadows. The trumpeter carried a beaded evening bag that looked antique. He might be somebody's father. Meadows had never been to a Mardi Gras. Maybe this was how one dressed for it. The mannish mix-matched socks, though, relieved him. Surely this was a joke.
"Carnival's getting so stuffy around here."
"And tacky." "But yes, Trixie, my love, tack-ack-y."
Blondie was helping to spread the pink gown out.
"We thought we'd get a head start and set a whole new tone, give Carnival some class. Know what I mean, sweetie?"
"Are you all transvestites or what?"
He could not believe his ears, could not believe what he was hearing had come out of his mouth. He stared at the most reasonable-looking one, noticing for the first time that in addition to the balloons, he was fleshy around the breasts and lumpy all on his own around the hips, and the mustache was clearly crepe, he realized now. A hermaphrodite, perhaps. Then, this scenario had more to do with black men didn't mince about in the streets for a joke. Still,
"You're a scream, sweetie. Say something else. You talk so cute. Speak, speak."
"You want this lovely number or not?"
Meadows found himself bending to help stuff the satin and lace back into the bag. They were cracking up at him one minute, then dancing by him single file the next, Blondie sassily flipping Meadows' tie up at the last minute. The chorus line looked more like a chain gang shuffling into meals, Meadows was thinking, or prisoners filing past him for a squirt of pesticide from the spray gun. He'd never have to do that kind of work again, he was telling himself, glad to have something to tell himself as they whipped around the corner, shouting, "Have a carnival, dearie." A moment later, it was like none of it had ever happened. The street was quiet, empty, no dogs even, no moving cars, just a piece of purple streamer on his shoe. What was that all about? He headed for what looked like a shopping center up ahead. Carnival did strange things to people, evidently. No black man he had ever known goofed on himself like that. He shrugged. Just a year before, he'd been asked to participate in a bicentennial pageant, a benefit given by the Guild for a school for deaf children. That was the closest he'd gotten to a carnival. Crispus Attucks, a good part, he'd thought. He had been flattered, had gotten a number of history books and acting primers out of the library, was ready to do it till he overheard at a Guild meeting that the role was to be played in blackface. On folding chairs directly in front of him, it was being discussed. Two of the so-called radical contingent who were forever disrupting the meetings, calling for a caucus, though they never did attract more than one or two Taiwanese or Pakistanis, who invariably left them to join either the main group or the Third World Caucus Meadows hadn't yet talked himself into joining. "You're kidding. Burnt cork in 1976? How droll. Seems the spade they asked to reenact the dying for liberty." And here, the teller slumped over the chair in a mock swan dive, his hands wagging Al Jolson style over his head. And it would not have been an effort at all. No effort at all. He could feel his foot rising. No effort at all to slip a loafer into the seat and shove the cocksucker onto his head. "Is too light to convey the message across the footlights. Blackface? Far fucking out. The Third World group will slaughter him. Lynch him. Tar and feather him first. How gross." They'd giggled, and he'd left. And for three nights running, he'd rehearsed his speech, the arch of the eyebrow, the curl of the lip, the sneer gilding his well-modulated voice. But no one ever contacted him further about it to give him the chance to decline. In his fantasies, snatched moments between racing from the emergency room to psychiatric, to the subway, to the deli, to the office he shared as junior member with three X Park Avenue GMPs, he saw himself in burnt cork, Crispus Attucks returns, ignoring the tomato sauce on the chest, turning his musket on them all, mowing down the redcoats, the whitecoats, the rest of the sons of bitches. And that had been his sole encounter with anything resembling a Mardi Gras. Just in front of him, sauntering out of a package store and throwing back over her shoulder at him a smile, a challenge, was exactly the kind of woman his father used to yell, "Hey, Big Stockings," at. She had her elbow planted in the flesh of one hip, a wine jug held out in the crook of her finger. But before he could work out his strategy, a flashy young dude stepped between them and took the jug in both hands like it was a bowling ball. They leaned their heads in, looked back at him, and laughed. He reddened and slowed his pace, expecting to have to jump any minute, the wine jug rumbling down the alley toward him. He cut down a side street, and then that encounter, too, drifted, gave way as though it hadn't happened, gave way to the stark reality of the street. This was evidently where the poorer people lived. There were broken-down stoops that looked like city and leaning porches that looked like country, houses with falling-away shutters and brick walkways that wouldn't make up their minds. Claiborne hadn't settled on its identity yet, he decided. Its history put it neither on this nor that side of the Mason-Dixon, and its present seemed to be a cross between a little Atlanta, a big Mount Bayou, and Trenton, New Jersey, in winter. Dented garbage cans, car shells, old Venetian blinds that hung askew. Across the way, a half-dressed woman in the open window, her breasts resting on pillows laid on the windowsill. The block, so like his first 100 lives ago, when army recruiters would set up booths in the empty storefronts and slap a poster up, the sudden bright colors eclipsing tattered liquor signs and old billboards urging the people to vote for Miss Ballantine. In spiffy uniforms with scrubbed faces, the white and black recruiters would be joking with the young men, passing out mess hall menus and glossy photos of soldiers in warm winter uniforms. How he'd wanted to get online and have his hand shaken and be told he could learn a trade with Uncle Sam, be sent to school, be somebody. Did they still recruit like that? Meadows shuddered. Meadows jumped. A snarling dog was heaving himself against a fence whose rattle said it might not hold. Stiff-legged and all teeth, the dog growled and snapped at the wire mesh, his body trembling.
"Don't pay no mind, mister."
A woman in housecoat and slippers grabbed the beast by his collar, dragging him back from the gate, mashing his head down between her knees.
"Shush, Roger, shush."
She was holding a bag of garbage. She would be opening the gate to get to the garbage can on the curb. Should he reach over the fence and take the bag for her? Would Roger find his way out of her knees and attack him? Meadows hurried down the street. A dark-skinned man with a cap yanked low over an unruly bush sat on the bottom step of one of the stoops up ahead. A wool plaid jacket that belonged on a boat or on a hunt. Elbows wedged between his knees, stock still, and waiting for a duck or a deer or a woman. Only the rifle was missing. "Welfare man," Meadows typed him. The small change half men who lived off mothers and children on welfare. He had seen them. Made a study of them, knew the look, the posture, in parks, on roofs, in bars, on stoops, but especially in supermarkets running their whining line while the women reached round them for a can of whatever was on sale. The boy men grabbing at their pocketbooks or their arms and the women saying, "No, man, gotta feed my kids." Then the wine heard all over the market and the women mashing the can against the shelf for 2 cents off for dents. "But mama, look here." Or, "Say, baby, I gotta," and then the, "Nah, man." But never a name, never names, a ritual, market theater with anonymous personae. He'd seen them back the women into the frozen food tank, bending their bodies back as if over a sofa arm, over a bedstand, pressing and pleading for a dollar walk-around money, or 69 cents for a pint to share with Shorty on the roof, or 50 for a game of pool with Bumpy, or 35 cents to put them into contending with the teenage basketball stars, or a dime, or a nickel, or a penny for the gumball machine. And by the time they got to the line and the welfare mamas were fishing out the coupons, worn out with all the haggling, the boy men would lean in for the kill, mashing their joints into the women, mashing the women into the shopping carts, the mesh outlined on ass or hips, the purses clutched so hard the vinyl tore.
"A dime, woman, a damn dime."
And the women, defeated, would dip into the coins and give it up, then look over the items moving along the belt for the one thing the children might possibly do without. Meadows approached the man on the stoop, his eyes on the two shoes jutting out that would have to be walked around. He studied the posture, the clothes, the nappy hair sticking out from under the cap. He had him pegged. He didn't have to look into the face. He never looked into the faces anyway. The nameless players were faceless, too. To look was not part of it. He couldn't look. He always turned his face away. They scared the shit out of him. Not in the bars so much, even when they were nasty drunk. Not on the streets so much, even when they stalked him and anybody else they thought they could put the bite on. They just angered him then. But in the supermarkets, the boy men were frightening. Frightening because the women were there, there, and losing, and because he was there, there, and helpless. Never a basket. Never with the women. The boy men raced in after the women in a rush of need and gotta and right now. And never a name. Mama, baby, woman, but never a name. And he would turn away, but stand there, hearing it, crushing the lettuce and looking for glass to smash, that mysterious directive from childhood in case of emergency smash glass, like ticker tape spreading across the produce. He wanted to turn and beat them. Bend the boy men into the stacks of frozen food and beat them with a rock Cornish hen or a 10-pound carton of solid hard chitterlings. And all the while, moving up online, he'd grip the cart handles till his knuckles went white and he'd turn his face away, bury his eyes in the TV guide or the jet, but hear it anyway. Well, a dime then. Damn, woman, just a dime. And he'd hear the weary sigh from the woman, hear the pocketbook open, and he'd turn and watch the woman. They all did it the same way, like they'd all studied under the same drama coach. They'd peer into the cavernous bags, wanting no doubt to fall in, jump in and close themselves up in there and be unavailable forever. And why did they never do it? What was it that kept them from diving in head first? What in that five-flight walk-up drudge of a life with babies and babies and pea-stained mattresses and welfare investigators poking in closets and cutting them off and cutting them down and these half-men whining and pleading and bending their wash-bent bodies into the cold tank? Why not? But always the hand came out of the bag with little clutch purses, and the purses were snatched at greedily by childish, unmannish hands. Wait now, just you wait one damn minute, man. One day he would snap. One day he would mount the counter shouting, "Use names, for Christ's sake. Haven't you niggers got any names?" He would run amok in the supermarket. Meadows was laughing out loud, trampling the man's feet and laughing out loud.
Watch it, honky.
Honky, you motherfucking dumb bastard. Don't you know a blood when you see one?
Get the fuck off my feet, whatever the fuck you are.
Two more men were coming out of the doorway. Then a woman with half her hair pressed and the other half raw came onto the porch, children swarming all around her hips.
You on the wrong side of town, buddy.
Meadows moved on fast. The warning from the tall dude by the door was not lost on him. Fat chance of trying to explain his feet's behavior in terms of supermarket memories, or trying to share the joke of the ubiquitous red box from subways, public buildings, movie houses that offered the magic instruction in case of emergency. And there he'd be in the supermarket, flying over the baskets to get at the boy men, landing in a clutter of cans and boxes and not a bit of glass to be had. No one remembering to buy a jar of pickled beets to supply him with the talisman. And there he'd be, getting pummeled by an army of those boy men who had read his intentions and put his name out on the wire, and him yelling, "Quick, Somebody, hand me a blunt instrument and quick, quick, somebody smash some glass. This is an absolute emergency. Hey, you. Coming up behind him were the stepped-on man and the tall dude from the doorway. Wait up. It was pointless to run. There were no alleys or driveways, and who knew what lay behind the 3-bar fence that read Dead End? With his luck, a sheer drop to a 4-lane highway.
Hey, buddy, we ain't gonna bother you.
The doorman held his hands palm up, the ancient sign, no spear, no knife, no hand grenade. You lost? In some kind of trouble? They were studying him. By now, they'd know he was not a honky. He felt himself coming into focus for them, like the movie stars on the lids of Dixie cups he'd licked long ago into being. Coming into view for them now, his red gold hair of no less than 5 grades, curly in front, stringy in back, wavy round the ears, slick on top, and downright nappy at the center. The barbers always went at the nigger hair with clippers ablaze, but couldn't bear to clip the curls or shorten the back, no matter how he instructed. Haircuts were a freak show. He licked his lips and tried to be patient. Now the grain of his skin would be coming into view, like a 35-millimeter blow-up. He was never more clear to himself than when black people examined him this way. Suspicious. He felt his nostrils flatten. For all his mother's pinching, his nose splayed out into his cheekbones now, as if for the first time, as though willed. And now they were checking out his clothes, the cat in the cap eyeing his watch. They were satisfied he was one of them, he sensed, though he wasn't fool enough to think being a nigger saved him. He felt his feet poised for flight, his arms flexed for a rumble. His adrenaline was up, the coagulants working double time in case of wound, in case a gush had to be staunched. What you doing round here? He tried to see under the bill of the cap. The face was a layer of shadows. The voice sounded suspicious, but not dangerous yet.
I'm visiting the infirmary.
Oh.
They exchanged glances.
You one of the new medics?
Yeah.
He was calm enough now to see them, feel them loosen up. The tall one, in a well-ironed denim suit, fished out a pack of cigarettes by the tail of gold cellophane and studied the picture of the camel as if for his next line. The shorter one in the cap kept his eyes on Meadows' watch.
We've been having some trouble around here.
The pack was being offered to him. He waved it aside with what he hoped was a cool air of nonchalance.
Transchemicals been sending goons, spies, bad times.
The man seemed to be making a question of it. What would he know about labor problems at the chemical plant if he were on a visit to the infirmary? Meadows waited.
What's your name? And who you work for?
Hold on now.
The taller one was pulling stepped on back by the arm, though he hadn't moved. His words, though, had shot forward and Meadows had backed up.
Where's your sense of hospitality? Your manners?
The tall one extended a hand.
I'm Thurston. This here's Hull. They call him M1. Meanest nigger in the world. And you gotta come along and step on his foot.
Feet, man. The fool stepped on my feet. Both of them.
Hey, I'm sorry. I've had a rough... I'm really sorry, brother.
You got a name, brother?
The nasty one jutted his chin up at him, and now he could see the whole face, the eyes. If this is what the welfare boy man looked like up close, so close, he'd keep on keeping his face turned away hereafter.
Meadows, I work for Doc Surge.
He lied, inspired.
Doc?
They exchanged looks again, visibly impressed.
He tell you to come round here and step on my feet?
Daydreaming. Just, man, I am really sorry.
You lucky, Meadows. If he'd been drunk, you'd be dead. Did Doc send you round with a message?
He paused for just a beat, then lowered his voice.
He's still coming tonight.
Meadows curled up the notebook against his fly, wondering if his subconscious was trying to signal him. But then he was sorry. The gesture had drawn their attention. They were looking down at his joint. He dropped the pad and discovered he was too afraid to retrieve it.
They've got a healing going on, he finally figured was something hip to be saying.
Oh, yeah?
The dude called Thurston, which had come across to Meadows as thirsty, seemed genuinely interested. The other one was still doing his X-ray act.
Who?
Velma Henry.
The two men exchanged glances again.
Obie's woman,
one of them said. Meadows didn't see which. He chose that moment to bend for his notebook.
What's the matter with her? He finally buried his foot up her ass?
Don't know.
Meadows addressed the notebook.
Something happened to her over at the plant.
Thirsty had lowered his voice again and was massaging his chin. Meadows shrugged. It didn't seem appropriate or discreet to say he thought it had been an attempted suicide. It hadn't looked like a serious attempt anyway, not compared to cases he'd seen in emergency. In addition, whatever he might say would only provide further questions he knew he could not answer. So he shrugged again and hoped they'd be interested enough to go make a call and leave him alone.
Doc'll know.
Thirsty was checking his watch, then waving them in the direction of the house.
Come on.
Thirsty straightened his jacket and was moving back down the street as though it was understood Meadows and the friend would follow. The man, called Emwan, was obviously waiting for Meadows to move. So he did. They fell in around him, flanked him. Meadows was on guard again.
Where you staying?
He rolled the notebook up and jammed it into his pocket.
Nadir's?
Who?
They both stopped, and he was now far enough ahead to consider making a run for it, but he hadn't got past their stoop yet, and there was a man sitting there breaking open a six-pack. And who knew, maybe the raging dog up ahead would jump the fence and come at him.
You mean Nadir? As in, Ma dear, everybody's good old boarding house grandma.
He felt himself redden, and they had caught up enough to see it, so they laughed at that, too. He was sure the woman in the floral hat, the woman who ran a boarding house, had been introduced by Doc Surge as Nadir. He'd thought it country classic.
You something.
The one in the suit slung an arm around his shoulder and was wagging his head.
Calling people out of their name.
Didn't your mama teach you nothing?
I won't embarrass you by asking you our names. My name's Thurston, as in need for a beer. This is Hull, as in walnut, called M1, as in rifle. Come on, my man, let's have a beer. Wish we could extend an invitation to Grit, but the cupboard's Mother Hubbard's. The larder is lean. The refrige reneged. The bones are picked clean. And the bread box is the private preserve of the roaches.
They slapped five in front of him, and he smacked their hands recklessly. And they laughed again. And Meadows wondered if he would get off LaSalle Street alive. He was a yaller nigger, in costly clothes with an Omega watch, an out-of-town cornball who'd stepped on somebody named M1 and called him in earshot of kith and kin a motherfucking dumb bastard. Friends had been killed for less. He'd seen a man impaled on a cue stick for questioning the rack-up. He'd seen a woman drowned in a bucket of Kool-Aid for broiling the steak medium well instead of medium rare. On Saturday nights, he'd seen lifelong friends dragging each other in, all cut up. Seen shot-up buddies who'd picked up the tip laid down for the barmaid, or had said Richard Pryor wasn't funny, or had dropped a deck of cards on the table with the seal split. He'd seen men who'd survived Korea or Vietnam together, hauling each other into emergency, apologizing to each other, a boot the only thing holding the foot and leg together, a starched collar holding a lopsided head on. Meadows exhaled and poked a fist right through his pocket. What the hell, he thought, squatting on the steps between them. A beer's a beer. Whatever happened, he wasn't stumbling aimlessly around the streets anymore, at loose ends, alone. 9. What's the good word, Shortcakes?
Pussy. And another good one is,
never mind. Ruby walked her elbows across the tiny cafe table.
That kid's mouth's getting to be an ecological disaster area, she moaned, dropping her head down into the crook of Jan's elbow.
The rest of the kids, tottering on skateboards or leaning their bikes against the railing, went right on talking to Jan while Shortcakes, balancing his skateboard to a standstill, took the opportunity to pinch from Ruby's plate what he took to be a crab apple.
Y'all going to the park tonight?
Wouldn't miss it for anything in the world, Jan answered, searching the table for something suitable to offer the kids.
Then you won't be firing the ashtrays tonight?
Tomorrow.
Do what?
Ruby looked up in time to see the kid bite into the hot cherry tomato.
Fire, bake, harden, cure. Oh, clay.
The women clamped their mouths shut, waiting for the hot pepper to register. The kids in on the joke hunched the others.
Mighty powerful pickling to get past all that foul sewerage.
Ruby laughed as the kid reached over the cafe railing to take a swipe at her, his face contorted. Speeding away, he meant to fling the hot tomato back over the railing, but his aim was off. The kids ducked, and it landed splat on the arm of the tall man in the bow tie, leaning against the railing by the entrance step, talking with the crowd of young people who wanted to know how come Muslims weren't around like before. The paper boy leaned over and took the napkin from Jan, and in passing it, got drawn in by Bow Tie, who was very interested in his paper route. The skateboard kids took off down the street on the ninth wave. The bikers, front tires high like a circus act, sailed into the street on the back tires only, slapping the metallic behinds of their thoroughbreds.
That's Velma's boy, the one with the papers.
You mean the one with the feet?
I know. And ain't that Tommy Jeter's boy?
Ruby was waving a tattered napkin at the back of the speed demon with his mouth on fire.
Gail says yes, Jeter says no.
Jeter must be crazy. Could have spit that kid right out of his mouth. Looks more like Jeter than Jeter.
He better claim that boy. This is a small town, and Jeter got lots of daughters growing up all over Claiborne. But what he care? What a man care about?
I hear where this conversation is headed, Ruby, and I do not want to hear no nigger man shit this afternoon. Can it?
That kiln big enough for Shortcakes and his daddy?
Ruby mumbled it, dropping her head down on her arms.
What's the matter with you here lately, Ruby?
Nate's on the road.
she muttered into her arms, trying to pull herself up. Or maybe it's something in the air. Maybe it's Velma. She's a for real drag lately. I think we need to ask her to step down. She's wearing everybody to a frazzle and taking on more work than she or anyone else can handle. Driven, compulsive, or maybe... She flopped back in the chair and stared out at the gray-purple clouds.
I don't know. Malcolm gone, King gone, Fannie Lou gone, Angela quiet, the movement splintered, enclaves unconnected.
Everybody off into the Maharaji this and the Right Reverend that. If it isn't some far-off religious nuttery, it's some otherworldly stuff. And check that out.
Jan turned, trying to follow Ruby's gaze. Past the microwave oven and the espresso machine was the makeshift stage where the musicians were climbing down for a break. The one brother in the band was wearing a Blues Brothers t-shirt. And Nate and the guys can't find a gig in town. It's enough to make you scream, ain't it? Next thing you know, some white boy in top hat and tails or maybe a dreads wig will come along and pied pipe all the folks to the lobotomy wards.
Don't start, Ruby. You always wind up getting things all mixed up and maudlin, too.
Jan picked among the remains of the salad they'd shared for one last shred of red cabbage. Ruby had asked her a serious question a moment ago, but then their favorite waitress had stopped by their table to say goodbye, stuffing her apron in her bag, and Jan hadn't answered.
Who, Ruby wanted to know, who could effectively pull together the folks? The campus forces, the street forces, the prison forces, workers, women, the aged, the gay.
And Jan had thought Doc Surge, but didn't get to say it even after the waitress left. The thundering of ball bearings had interrupted them, and just as well, for she'd been idly shuffling the tarot deck, forgetting how scathing Ruby could get about that stuff, and the magician had slipped from the pack. Lately, each time the team had sat down, Daisy Moultrie on the Ouija board, Mrs. Haywood's protege on the energy maps, Bertha with the cowries, Levita with the charts, the magician had fallen from the deck. She wished to discuss her misgivings about Doc, but in her own terms, wanted to discuss how a people turned around might not read the difference between the figure straight up and the figure reversed. Ruby was looking at her sideways, and Jan wanted a peaceful lunch. She plopped the deck in the top of her bag, the cards immediately spilling between her eyeglass case and her cosmetic sack. She snapped her bag shut. The two women leaned back while the waiter cleared away the salad plate, noted their clean forks and missing napkins, and offered each a corner of his apron to wipe their hands.
Those your kids?
Some of them used to be in my class.
Jan looked up. Some take classes with me at the
academy,
Campbell said. He couldn't help it. Had been meaning to make some contact with the woman for weeks. She was always on the run and rarely ate on his shift.
I'll get you a damp towel.
You know, Ruby leaned forward. I don't want to press anything on you, but getting back to this leadership question, you and Serge are the only...
Ruby.
Okay, Jan, but the truth is, I'm glad you got fired. I mean it. Murder-mouthed in the yard, jumped on the stairs, ripped open at recess, and still you wanted to go right on trying to teach hardened crapshooters the beauty of Train A leaving the station 2 hours before Train B traveling at X minus miles per foot.
Ruby.
And I know, Jan, things are great for you at the Academy, but it's a waste of your talent. The Academy's non-functional in the broad sense, too inbred. You can't leave the heavy business of running this city to the fools like Jay Patterson and the like. Now, you know I don't believe in all this fate stuff you characters be into up there in your little study group, but doesn't it occur to you that you were relieved of duty? So to speak, so that you'd be freed up to take on some serious work?
Ruby, do me a favor.
I know. I'm being a drag.
Is anyone on the grill? I don't trust that microwave.
Campbell had quickly slid a plate of steamed washcloths onto the table and now glanced around toward the service counter window to the kitchen. She would want toasted banana nut bread. He knew that. First break in traffic, and he would do it himself. He nodded. She smiled. She was a serious sister, and good-looking, too, in an offbeat sort of way. A pointy Dick Tracy face, plucked eyebrows, braids piled high and held in place by a tie-dye scarf, always a tie-dye of brilliant colors, so that it looked like she carried a basket of snakes on her head, did the books at the academy, and taught sculpture at night and ceramics in the afternoon. Odd combination. He hoped she'd be around when he got off. Maybe he could ply her with toasted cake for the next 2 hours. "Leave it to me," he said, just in case she hadn't read him. Banana nut bread, toasted. He set down the cups, a larger pot of red zinger tea than they'd ordered, 2 plates of spinach quiche, and a plastic bear with a yellow hat where the honey came out of. The women looked at the bear, looked at each other, looked at him.
"I just work here, y'all."
He shrugged. A reeling drunk was doing the rope-a-dope number against the railing for the benefit of Bowtie and the youth, but they were engrossed in a discussion of the Honorable Elijah's heir, Wallace Farrakhan, a yet-to-be-known. Campbell stepped away from the table to urge the drunk on his way.
"I want to talk to teacher lady. Hey."
He was hailing Jan, who did not recognize him.
"Ain't you the school teacher from up the way?"
His finger pointed toward a VW station wagon parked at the curb, toward the chemical plant smokestacks in the distance, toward the sidewalk he stood on as he fell along the railing again. He approached their table as if he too were on a skateboard.
"I support education,"
he announced to diners looking away from him or through him. He pulled a pint bottle from one of his uniform's many pockets and examined it carefully for damage.
"I pay my taxes. See?"
It was show and tell time, the seal ragged and dirty.
"See how much taxes I pay each hour on the hour to educate the children. Such dedication deserves applause, don't it?"
6 men at the round table under the awning toasted him, and he bowed and drank. Bowtie bowed, too, and continued talking about messengers.
"Who are you?"
She stared at him as at a long-forgotten object of historical importance, heard about, finally encountered. An ancient piece of pottery, the Rosetta Stone, a scroll from a pharaoh's tomb. She held her breath. He seemed to be holding his, too, pulling himself up out of the fumes to stand before her steady, revealed at last. She tried to memorize the lines, the planes, the puffiness here, the broken capillaries there. As though instructed, she'd have but one chance to bone up for the exam, one chance in a lifetime to know it. He was somebody. That was as far as she could get. She might get Bertha to throw the cowries on it. She might spread the tarot on it. He was no fool, and not the Joker, a fool who's been around, either. But he was somebody in her kin, and she would know it.
"What's your name?"
She asked it quietly, the way you would a child, suddenly appearing out of nowhere on your front stoop in the middle of the night, half-dressed and scared, or an alley cat who insists its presence on you and will not drop its stare and gets you hypnotized into believing it's come straight from Egypt with the word.
"They call me one thing or another."
He had grabbed hold of the railing just below Ruby's elbow and was teetering back and forth.
"Good luck, teacher lady,"
bowing deeply from the waist.
"Take care."
He strolled off.
"What was that about?"
Ruby shivered.
"I don't know. Eerie." I get the feeling.
But she hadn't isolated any of the feelings well enough to put a name to. She shrugged, troubled. Ruby tipped her chair back to get a good look at the drunk crossing now between a mail truck and a milk truck. He seemed to be heading toward the lot that swings down toward the park.
He's made a remarkable recovery, seems to me.
Not so much reeling and rocking as bopping and strutting.
Isn't he one of Doc Surge's cut buddies?
Her chair was dangerously tipping now, and but for a disturbed diner at the next table, she would have fallen backward.
A regular Scarlet Pimpernel.
He's disappeared.
Change that to the Green Hornet. Was that a hospital orderly outfit, or garage attendant uniform, or green beret, or what?
I get my greens mixed.
Green. Jan strained to recall a conversation half heard. She'd been loading the kiln with the masks Obi had asked for the parade and trying to meet Ruby on time. Behind the utility rack on the other side of the wall, a meeting was going on. The Brotherhood, most likely. Several had come into the hall, stood behind her door, almost closed it, locking her in, and then appeared to be suspicious at finding her there. Something about a man in green giving the signal for things to start.
Velma coming, or can I gobble up everything?
I don't know. We were supposed to meet this morning. She didn't show.
No telling where she is, Ruby was saying, attacking the quiche. She blew the second executive committee meeting in a row last night. Probably another one of those out-of-town jobs. How she ever got clearance to do government work with her background is past my brain. Big-time computer jobs for civil service and so forth.
I thought she was working at the plant.
Transchemical? Velma?
How'd she manage to juggle that contradiction, working for the enemy? Either she's lifting info or sabotaging the works.
Ugh! I've hit on something.
Jan sat still, feeling Ruby waiting. Waiting and not chewing, knowing she'd stumbled onto something.
Well, Jan, if it's such a big secret, then pass me that squeezable bear. I need to squeeze me something.
Oh, for a stationary man. Stationary man.
You know that Nathan Harge has been on the road more days this month than he's been at home.
He coming home for the festival?
I'm so sick of all this festival crap. Couldn't get any business done at all at the meeting last night, everybody talking about the festival.
But check this. Me and Bertha did get this done. And this is what I was getting ready to talk about when you thought I was going off about Jeter and man shit. A manhood conference. Velma worked on it a bit last week.
Ruby was diving under the table, wrestling with her ubiquitous tote bag. 'Cause let's face it, she said from under the table, women for action is taking on entirely too much. Drugs, prisons, alcohol, the schools, rape, battered women, abused children. And now Velma's talking the group into tackling the nuclear power issue, and the Brotherhood ain't doing shit about organizing.
Oh, I don't know.
The Brotherhood has bullshit. They've gotten so insulated and inbred up there in the cozy corner of the Academy's East Wing, having their id-egoological debates, no one even sees them anymore. And you know it. So quit the understanding, standing by the men, good supportive sister crap. 'Cause you the one that started it. Yeah, you. Weren't you telling Velma just last week that half the shit that goes down between men and women is leftover nonsense between brothers and brothers?
What?
Couples and business gatherings at the various tables were turning their way, watching Ruby drag the bag up into her lap to wrestle with its contents. The Academy. Jan was tired of hearing the Academy applauded or lambasted, whether because of the Brotherhood or the programs or the kids or now this rumor of guns. It was like Mrs. Haywood said, keep the focus on the action, not the institution. Don't confuse the vehicle with the objective. All cocoons are temporary and disappear.
Ruby,
what's that song Sun Ra does about this planet being a cocoon or a railway station or some kind of temporary? A spaceship?
because men drive around with each other instead of dealing for real, and later for all the beating on the chest raw gorilla shit, all the unresolved stuff slops over into man/woman relationships.
Give me an example, Ruby, or better yet, shut up.
Sister, please, give yourself an example. You were brilliantly expounding on the subject just last Tuesday. I got my own troubles.
Yanking at a spiral notebook that was caught in the straps of the bag. We designed a questionnaire, a thing that could be sent out to get ideas for workshops, panels, speakers, films, and stuff like that. Mostly, flopping the notebook on the table and shoving the teacups out of the way, the questionnaire is designed to provoke some thought about paternity and rape and misogyny and what have you. Ruby flipped furiously, yanked out a bunch of papers, and handed them across the table.
See what you think. Here, take a pencil and edit away.
In other words, Ruby, you want my input.
Don't be difficult. We worked around the clock on this thing. Besides, we need you. I'm a ball-busting bitchy so-and-so. Velma's a dogmatic hardliner thus and such, and Daisy's big and fat and still lives with her parents. You, on the other hand, are above reproach. So sign on. I want to hand it to Velma to pass on to Obi, assuming they're speaking these days. He's the only one up there likely to get them brothers off their big, fat, rusty dusters and...
Ruby. Okay, I will be cool.
It sounded like thunder in the distance at first, and people paused, forks poised, glasses halted, heads turned this way or that, as people sniffed the air, studied the sky, or otherwise attempted to discover whether a storm was coming. Drums. Only drums. From somewhere near the corner of Gaylord and 10th came the pitted tabakabata of small drums, echoed by the rada-rada booming from the park. Then the jukebox from inside the cafe drowned it all out with the strains of a recent release of Dexter Gordon's Tower of Power. The tinkle of glasses and metal against plates resumed, and the hubbub of the outdoor diners rose. Ruby twisted round in her chair, frowning at the musicians streaming by the dessert cart to a special table in the corner. She hoisted herself up 2 inches, pressing down on the fragile wire arms of the chair to do it, and cleared her throat. When the Europeans stopped killing Christians and became Christians, that was the end of Christianity and the beginning of Christendom and Christ idolatry. And when the white boy quit lynching niggers and became a nigger, that was the beginning of the Wild Bill Doggett revival and the beginning of Bloods wearing Blues Brothers emblems. When, oh, when will confusion end, my sister? Tell us, oh, Janice-faced Janice, what's the deal?
They're drummers in the park, Ruby.
Why don't we go now? Dancers and incense and fresh fruit. Don't you have a booth?
Too much confusion down there.
No, I don't have a booth. I'm sick of all this pagan spring celebration shit and everybody handing out flyers about this rally and that meeting. Scattered, fragmented, uncoordinated mess. I'm so sick of leaflets and t-shirts and mouthy causes and nothing changing. All I want is a good blowtorch and some paying customers for a change. And if one more rat tooth motherfucker strolls into my shop asking to trade some cockeyed painting looking like a portable toilet for one of my masterpiece bracelets, I'm gonna run amok in the streets, I swear.
Let's go have a drink somewhere. Or are we waiting for Velma?
Jan put the wad of papers under her elbow. She was in no mood for the cagey questions and printed confrontations.
I'm not sure Velma's coming. We were supposed to meet at the lawyer's.
Oh? Tell it.
Well, she's probably sick, and no wonder. The plant is not a healthy place to work, even in the office wing.
Do you know that all the workers have to report for a medical once a month to the company infirmary? Plus, they can't see their own records.
Never mind that.
Ruby had reached across the table and tapped Jan's arm.
Tell it.
Jan exhaled noisily and frowned.
It seems somebody at the plant wiped out the entire records.
How does somebody do that?
By moving low values to first byte and then propagating it through the entire database.
Ruby patted Jan's arm and let the cigarette dangle for a minute before she puffed, letting it out through half-opened mouth and nostrils.
You want to break that down, teacher, to some basic Ronald McDonald-type English?
This somebody fouled up the entire computer bank, erased all the records, all gone, total blank, empty.
Beautiful.
And they'd think it was our very own Friday Foster.
But you said lawyer.
She was called in and questioned.
Let's say interrogated when we tell the tale.
Ruby, let's not say anything, okay?
Oh, shucks.
Ruby placed her cigarette in the ashtray and pulled her chair in closer. She set the teacups on the blowing napkins and then jammed her hat on tighter.
Velma, do it.
Jan stirred her tea, stalling. She was not sure why she hesitated to speak of it since she'd gone this far, was not even sure how she'd developed the theory.
My hunch, she said slowly, is that Jamal did it using a touch telephone. You remember Jamal?
The guy that always smells like incense? Yeah, but touch tone? You're losing me.
Ruby hunched forward on her elbows, hugging the pot, cup, honey and saucer to her so that Jan, too, could lean forward at least as far as Ruby's wide-brim hat would allow. They looked and felt like conspirators. The waiters, several passers-by, a few people from nearby tables, glanced their way. At a table in the corner by the service counter window, the informer, calling himself Donaldson, looked up from his notepad, leaned away from the table he'd been studiously eavesdropping on to lean toward the table by the railing where the two women sat huddled, oblivious of the napkins, candy wrappers, matchbooks blowing up against the table legs.
Had robbed a bank out in California, Sacramento, I think, by using a touch-tone telephone to speak directly to the computer to make withdrawals, bypassing the recording apparatus.
Donaldson could make little of the whispering. He settled back in his chair. The three men to his right were far more to his liking anyway. At the table were three out-of-work writers, exploring the possibility of a script to present at the Academy Writing Workshop that night. They were waiting on Campbell to take a break and be a sounding board. They had three ideas. One, the kidnapping of the two men who possessed the Coca-Cola formula, the ransom to be broadcast worldwide a month before the 1980 Olympics. Russia, France, China, and the U.S. must each divest itself of all nuclear arms and space hardware, or there'd be no more Coca-Cola produced. They rather liked that one. The taller of the two had clipped articles about Coca-Cola franchises in the Soviet Union and the People's Republic to the one-page treatment and placed it on the edge of the table, vaguely aware that some nosy joker at the next table was ruining his eyes trying to read it. The second treatment called for a less expensive budget. The two men, paid to guard the Titans, instructed to shoot the other in case of bizarre behavior, have each come to the conclusion that the other is a security risk and stalk each other through the bunker. The third was similar. In a plane circling the strategic warhead site in Phoenix were the two men with the keys to destruction. On orders given over the hotline from the Pentagon, they're to insert the two keys simultaneously to activate the missile. At the moment, the plane has hit some bumpy weather and flown above the turbulence. They've had to use oxygen for a bit and are now totally bananas and scheming to insert the keys without the order. They're that bored, nuts, frustrated. The three bloods slapped five and toasted themselves with Perrier and lime.
Campbell will want to check the fact sheet. He's a bug about documentation.
I know.
I've typed that up on the blue sheets. The older brother took the opportunity to lift his brows and dart his eyes in the direction of the informer.
Yeah, I checked him out the minute we sat down. I recognized him from before, calls himself Incognito. We ought to work him into the script somehow, blow his cover. That'd be stupid. At least we know him now.
True. The three huddled together in imitation, it would seem, of the two women by the railing.
And Jamal used to pick Velma up for lunch at the office and ask a lot of questions about the system, she was saying.
Campbell gave his writing buddies a 5-minute sign, then worked his way around the round table under the awning, gathering up glasses and emptying ashtrays, one eye on his work, the other on Jan and Ruby, curious about what secrets they might be sharing. With one hand, he anchored the tray on the edge of the table so as not to interrupt the men at their game. With the other hand, he flapped the bill against his teeth and watched and waited. They always spun to see who'd pay for each round of drinks. There were 6 of them, 5 white Americans and 1 Japanese, who kept his own liquor supply in one of the bar's lockers, plum wine, sake, and a mason jar that looked like corn liquor to Campbell. They always sat under the awning and usually at one of the 2 large round tables on his station. They always tipped well and always drank a lot. Their repertoire of games was extensive and peculiar to their profession. In a day or so, Campbell planned to introduce to them a new game, a board game, as soon as his papers were filed at the Copyright and Patent Office. For now, he watched and waited. They were spinning a cigarette lighter. Sometimes it was the salt shaker. Usually it was the instrument with the knobs and the centigrade markings he'd at first associated with quality control at a textile mill, but knew now gauged water levels. The lighter head pointed to the whiner, who groaned immediately and mopped his bald head with a napkin. Campbell had names for all of them. Sudsy Sam, who always ordered a pitcher of beer and a frosted stein. Rising Sun, who never wore white shirts and ties like the rest, but bronze-colored shirts with kimono collars. Piltdown Pete, who seemed too dumb to be a nuclear engineer, was no doubt some sort of lower echelon technician they allowed into their august company because perhaps he was so totally out of their league he usually wound up paying the checks. Krupp's Creep, in Orlon shirts and hats that were too small, forever lecturing about the necessity of beating out the Ruskies. The Grim Reaper, a name they themselves came up with, for he was constantly spoiling the fun by calling attention to the latest studies that threatened the expansion of nuclear power plant production, and the whiner, who had kids with braces, an overwhelming mortgage, problem-prone in-laws, and a frigid wife, all of which he managed to bring into the discussions, whatever the topic.
Let's see,
the whiner stammered, glancing around the table but catching no one's eyes. Rising Sun was working a cigarette into an ivory holder and reaching for the lighter. The rest had eyes riveted to their wristwatches.
You guys have managed to cover all the good methods. Let's see.
He was swinging his thighs, banging his knees under the table, reminiscent of one of Campbell's early tormentors in grade school. The whiner was tapping his nails against the tabletop, rapping louder and louder, his legs swinging more and more furiously.
Suppose I were to pull an insulation sheath over the water gauge and then insert a piece of stiff plastic. Jam the water gauge with a credit card or an ID badge?
Hell no. Stafford's already done that one. Pay the check.
Wait a sec. Hear me out. I didn't say anything about the coolant system or the water pumps.
Time's up. Pay the waiter. That's not fair. You guys are really not being fair. I've got 2 minutes.
2 minutes start to finish. You haven't even identified which section of the fail-safe system you're tampering with.
Waiter, another round of drinks, another pitcher of beer, and make sure the stein is good and frosted. Pay up, Nickelberry.
You guys are really not fair.
This is a stupid game anyway, unpatriotic to say the least. We could be court-martialed for this.
We're not military, Nickelberry. Just pay the man.
Campbell scooped up the whiner's credit card and whisked the tray away. If he was fast and the relief waitress had come in on time, he could get back to Jan in minutes. Maybe sit down with the two women for his break. He'd see his writing buddies soon enough at the workshop.
Had this dream. I told Velma about it, and she just looked. You know how she looks when... Anyway,
in the dream, Jamal was sitting on a black leather bar stool with a red touch-tone telephone on the table. He had a yellow scrap of paper on his lap, and he was...
Is there a warrant out for her, or what? How serious is it?
They're calling it a routine inquiry. Naturally, they're trying to keep the whole thing quiet, not only because of all the records, payroll, orders, invoices. Hell, I don't have a clue as to what they had computerized, but...
Jan scraped her chair closer to Ruby, tipping the brim of her hat back.
There's another reason. They've been shipping flat cars of slag, they call it, some kind of contaminated sludge, right through town to some burial grounds for radioactive waste that a plant in Alabama uses. And Velma pulled the info and passed it on to some investigative journalist, right?
I've been following the Jack Anderson articles.
No, I don't think so.
Passing it on to some environmentalist group, then?
I really don't know, Ruby. She called me to ask me to put her in touch with some lawyers. As for lifting, remember last time she leaked some material?
How well I remember. And the turkey got up in court and named his source. Funny how a subpoena can scare the shit out of you. What's the rest?
I don't know, Ruby. That's why I was hoping she'd come this afternoon for lunch. She blew the appointment this morning for the lawyer, a friend of mine, and he was some pissed.
No wonder she's been acting so crazy.
Ruby slumped back in her chair and let her arms dangle behind her.
Pressure. I'm such a crummy friend. Here she's been under all this pressure lately, and I've been so insensitive.
No wonder. She really needs to get out of the plant. Everybody does.
Ruby took her hat off and placed the brim under the legs of her chair. It was hot and muggy, and the gusty wind was no relief. She leaned back again, swinging her arms and looking up at the smeary clouds.
If the fumes are anything to go by, she said, looking toward the smokestacks, Dante didn't tell the half of it.
More practical than the game Fission, and a bit less cynical than the game Failsafe Fooey, was the board game Campbell developed and hoped to market through Parker Brothers, Disposal. Each player received at the start a sum of money, some property, nuclear reactors, uranium mines, etc., 5,000 pounds of uranium tailings, and a load of contaminated items